Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we welcome back Alan Steele, the asset manager. So, hi Alan, how are you?
Well, I'm very well today. Thank you very much.
Great. And Kenny, how are you?
Yeah, all good. At least I've made the podcast in time today, so that's a start.
Yeah. Well done for that. So Alan, what's going on with you?
I was reading a book, which, you know, I usually start off a conversation with people saying, I've been reading this book. And people say, do you always read books? I go, I read books all the time. I'm reading this book by a guy called Christopher Mayer, which is M-A-Y-E-R, which is actually quite fascinating. And it's called How Do You Know? You know, that's what the book's called, How Do You Know? And it says it's a guide to clear thinking about, you know, investing in life and stuff like that. And it's really, really interesting because we use things all the time and we just accept what it says on television, that that's the case or this is the case or, you know. And there's some examples. I mean, you know, what, I have a, basically because I'm so cynical and I've found that so many things that are supposed to be facts actually turn out not to be facts, I tend to just never accept at face value what I'm being told by a consensus. And there's a very simple example. 30th of November, there was a headline in the media that said the 2020 Atlantic hurricane season was a record breaker. You know, and I go, oh, was it? I wasn't aware that there was a lot of hurricanes. Yeah. And then you go and you check. It's very easy to check this, by the way. You just go and you just go and Google it. And there was 13 hurricanes, apparently. In the hurricane season in 2020, there was 15 in 2005. You know, 50. So how is that a record breaker? In 1970, there was 12. Well, there's not much difference between 12 and 13, is there?
Not really.
And very similar levels back in 1888 or the late 19th century, and so on. So you think, well, actually, that's wrong. Yeah. And it doesn't take much time to find out it's wrong. I'll give you another simple example. I was, I'm on Twitter quite a lot because I like annoying people and or at least try to make them laugh. Or so it's very difficult sometimes to make some of these people laugh. And I did a lot. There's a girl that follows me and she's got thousands of followers and she's Welsh. And she put a thing out on Saturday night or something like that. And it was like, and she went, what are you peeps doing tonight to cheer yourselves up or something like that? And I tweeted back, listening to Neil Young. Now, that's not everybody's idea of cheering themselves up, I suppose. But I quite like Neil Young, so I listened to Neil Young.
I like a bit of some of his songs, and even the damage done. I like listening to that one live when I'm out walking. It's quite harrowing, that one.
Well, it's interesting because I've got another pal who's an IFA and he's a hard Glasgow man himself and he's a bit of a music buff and he played in a band and things like that. And he spent 3 years recently in Winnipeg in Canada. And he came back, he'd obviously picked up the tweet, and he came back and said, he's a pegger man, which obviously means Winnipegger. And I went back and said, that's funny. How is he a Winnipegger when he was born in Ontario? And he said, how do you know that? I said, well, there's a song called Ontario, and it's, the chorus is, I was born in Ontario. And it's like, it's very simple, isn't it? So then he came back and said, you know, it was such common knowledge in Winnipeg that I didn't bother to check. And to me, you know, these two examples say that when somebody says something, or, you know, when an expert or the consensus is this, what you should do is, well, why don't you just go and check for yourself, which is nullius in verba. And I mean, that can bring us on, I suppose, to COVID, which has been described by somebody as COVID nonsense.
Let's save it for the podcast, Alan, and we'll start.
Oh, sorry, I thought we had started.
Yeah, no, we have started. We have. I've recorded it. Yeah, we've started.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit. Yeah, I thought we were just having a chat.
No, we've started, yeah. So You know, I'll edit out this little bit here. But I thought I'm going to push record. Alan's taken the lead and is on going on. So I'm going to push record. But you know, COVID. Then what's the situation at the moment, Alan? What are your feelings on COVID?
Well, there's a lot. It's like, how do you know? And you sort of say, it's terrible. And this question, this book has actually kind of changed my thinking. I mean, I'm always a cynic, and I'm always going, well, let's just check for yourself, which is nullius in verba, let's check for yourself. But that actually gives you a subtitle, and, you know, how do you know? And you go, well, let's just check this COVID thing. According to official numbers, by the end of November, it says 5,564 people in Scotland have died with COVID, 92% of whom had an average of 2.7 comorbidities, which basically means that they were on their last legs. Out of that 5,564, only 38 of the ones under 45 died. So only 38 people under the age of 45 died in Scotland out of 5,564. And that's a very low percentage, isn't it? You think, well, that's not very many. I think I found out it was something like 0.6%.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody locally in Linlithgow and said, 0.6%, it's only 38 people and 0.6%. And she said, well, what's the population of Linlithgow? And I said, well, it's about 14,000. And she said, well, that means that almost over 100 under 45s would die. And I said, how do you work that one out? And she'd actually, what she'd forgotten to do is remember that the population of Scotland is 5.5 million. So 38 people out of 5.5 million have died under the age of 45 with COVID. And there's a fair chance, I would have thought, that far more people under 45 have died with suicide. Because in an average year, allegedly, it's about 800 people in Scotland commit suicide, and three quarters of them are male, and most of them are under 45 years old.
Mm.
And yet nobody seems to be caring about that.
So I find
that confusing. I also find confusing that the life expect, according to 2017-19 tables, life expectancy at birth for males in Scotland is 77 years, and for women it's 81 years. But the average mean death in Scotland in COVID is 79 for males and 84 for females. So these people are dying who actually have lived longer than their life expectancy said they would. I just find the whole thing. I mean, I realise that there are some people who have got this and it's been seriously bad for them and it's been out of the blue. Apparently, according to numbers, 8%, they can't work out that they had anything previous. Only 8%, 92%. But it's interesting that all this thing about vaccines, and I compare that with, I did a lot of research on Pennsylvania. I don't know if you know that Pennsylvania is the only place in the world that actually has detailed COVID fatality stats per five-year cohorts, from birth to five, and five to 10, and 10 to 15, and right up to 100 to 105, and 105 to 110. And it's fascinating because it's estimated that 0.03% of the population of Pennsylvania is over 100. But they've got 30% more deaths than the under 45-year-olds, which make up 55% of the population. Now, people get confused with percentages, but that means that you've got about 2,000 times more chance of dying of COVID if you're over 100 in Pennsylvania than if you're under 45. Unfortunately, they don't have stats about over 100s in Scotland. They only have it for 90+. But people say, it's Pennsylvania, so what? Well, Pennsylvania is actually bigger than Belgium. It's got almost 13 million population, and Scotland only has 5.5 million. So there's a lot of stuff going on that you just didn't understand. But then look at the damage that's been caused, with the overreaction I think, of governments. And clearly they got it wrong at the beginning, because they obviously should have protected the elderly and the and the ill. They should have, obviously. It's pretty, but nobody, you'll never get any of them to admit that, will you?
No, absolutely. Did you see, Alan, something from, there's a guy called Alan Jones who works for Sky News in Australia. And I think it was actually, it must have been broadcast. I mean, it's a clip on, I've just found it here, Sky News Australia. So it must have been broadcast. And he's basically effectively reality checking COVID. And like you say, so the USA deaths from COVID 0.07, Italy 0.06, France 0.05, Sweden 0.06, UK 0.07. So, you know, that's the people who've actually died of COVID, not with it, but of it, you know?
That's right. It's, you know, you just kind of wonder. I mean, how people will not challenge things. They won't. You know, I found something else that I thought was interesting. You know, it's like when you look at a map of the world, Greenland looks like it's a lot bigger than Australia. Yeah. But actually, Australia is four times the size of Greenland.
Mm.
But then, so things are can be an illusion. You can get, you know, and percentages confuse people as well. You know, if I ask somebody what's 0.05% of 100,000, most people haven't got a clue. Having said that, I haven't got a clue either when I ask it. But I'll give you a funny story about that, because percentages do confuse people. I was in Tesco some time ago. It was a couple of years ago, but it illustrates the point. And I'm quite into Malbec red wine. I'm into red wine actually anyway, but I kind of like Malbec. So Tesco's got a special offer on, and it's 50% off Malbec. Mm. You go like, off that. So I'm taking a couple of bottles of Malbec, and there's a wee wife standing beside me, a wee old wife, even older than me. I'm old, but she was older than me. And she nudges me and she said, you're better with this one, son. And I said, what one? She said, this one here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's buy one, get one free. She says, aye. I said, it's the same. She said, no, it's different. I said, how do you mean it's different? She says, 100% off. I said, no, buy one, get one free is the same as 50% off two bottles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No. She said, it's 100% off. At that point, I realized I was going to lose, heavily here. So I just said, well, I prefer the Malbec. She went, well, please yourself. And off she went. And she obviously thought that buy one, get one free was 100% off. He's thinking, you know, and she's, how do people actually fall for all this sort of thing? And it's all over the place. So COVID, you know, I find it really peculiar that there are such. And people are so, it's binary, isn't it? People, if you're a denier, it's like climate change, you're a denier.
Yeah.
You know, climate change, you talked about Greenland, you know, why is it called Greenland? Why was it not called Whiteland? I mean, you know, if when they discovered it, apparently it was discovered sometime after 800 AD, and that was the time of, there was a warmer climate, wasn't there? There was the medieval warm period that they wanted to try and airbrush away. And when they arrived there, they obviously found that they could grow things because it was green. So then the climate changed and it became icy, but it's still called Greenland. But then when you say that to somebody, they you just get poo-pooed away. You're a nutter. You're just a nutter. And there's a wonderful quote that I found, and it comes from presumably a Roman. It says, the object of life is not to be on the side of the majority, but to escape finding oneself in the ranks of the insane. And there's a guy called Marcus Aurelius in 150 AD or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this thing about being deniers and consensus clearly goes right back through time, doesn't it? It must do. That kind of, you could say that brings you on to Brexit. One of the things you wanted to talk about was Brexit.
Well, yeah, there's Brexit, yeah. But before we move on to Brexit, why do you think governments are reacting like this? Because the damage is incredible. I mean, we don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but, you know, is it a conspiracy or is it just, I don't know, insanity?
Well, it's if you go back to the beginning, when this all started, I've written about this, and every time I mention it, I get fewer followers on Twitter and things like that. but Imperial College, yeah. Neil Professor Ferguson developed a model which predicted that COVID in the UK would kill up to 500,000 people, and in America would kill up to 2.2 million people. And when you're faced, if you're the government, I feel sorry for whoever was in government. I mean, it says, "Oh, like Boris is an idiot." Or, it wouldn't matter who was in government, whether it was Labour or Liberal or. Yeah. Or whatever. If you're there in government and you're getting these people who allegedly are world experts in it, and then Sage, who are a 50 people or whatever, apparently, who, by the way, all seem to think the same, so they probably didn't have any sense of humour, I would have thought. And they certainly don't have any specialist epidemiologists in it, and they've got quite a few mathematicians. If they are saying the same thing as he's saying, and you are in government, what are you going to do? Are you going to say, "Ah, don't be daft, we're just going to follow Sweden"? Or do you think, well, if they're right, I'm wrong, I'm going to get, I'll go down in history as being a complete buffoon. Mind you, you'll go down in history anyway as being a buffoon, but never mind. But you get my point. So what do? They think that means that hospitals will just be overladen with people. They'll not be able to cope. So what do? They take people out of the hospitals. If you've been in a hospital recently, if you've got anything wrong with you, you go in, you get keyhole surgery or whatever, and you're out the same day. If you're still in hospital, it means you're seriously ill. Mm. So they take all these seriously ill people, they don't test them, because I don't suppose there's a test at the time, and they dump them in care homes. Mm-hmm. Now, care homes, as my granny used to call them, was God's waiting room. So people in care homes are on their last legs. I know one case, a local undertaker told me of somebody in a care home, was a 96-year-old woman who had so many things wrong with her. He said a strong curry would have killed her. And she was put down as COVID. So they started off on the wrong footing. And I think they just went worse from there.
Do you agree with them then? Do you agree it was the right thing to do? You know, any government would have done the same thing, but they should have reversed almost on the decision, you know, when the reality became clear.
If they'd had some common sense, they'd go, well, wait a minute, if we take seriously ill people at the hospitals and we just dump them in the care homes without testing them, what could happen? We might have a lot of deaths in the care homes. And of course, that's what happened. So you think they would have thought of that a bit more carefully, having done it, and then they massage the numbers of those who are dying because they put COVID on almost every death certificate. You've got a situation where, are they ever going to stand up and say, by the way, I'm really, really sorry, we got it wrong? Have you ever heard a government ever do that? Yeah. What they're doing now is they're covering their arse. Mm-hmm. So they will never admit that they were wrong. And we get these crazy things that are coming out, tier one, tier two, tier three. You got a situation here. It's pretty obvious if there are more cases coming along, it's pretty obvious they're coming along in places where there's a lot of population. They're called cities or big towns, I suppose. Mm. But that's where all the cases are. But what do? And then you take West Lothian. Now, West Lothian used to be called Linlithgowshire, and it stretched from the coal fields up at Fauldhouse and Bathgate and so on, all the way down to the coast at the Forth, including Bowness, Blackness, and South Queensferry. That was West Lothian, or Linlithgowshire, included all these areas. But when the borders got moved with whatever it was called, the subfinalisation, when they decided to create districts, they, for some unknown reason, cut Bowness and Blackness off and put it into Falkirk District region, and they cut Queensferry and put it into Midlothian. So at the moment, right now, Linlithgow, which is in the countryside, is tier four. It's going down to tier three on Friday. Bowness is in tier three, going down to tier two on Friday. And one of the best restaurants for miles is Champney Restaurant, which is about 100 yards or 50 yards inside Falkirk District, but it used to be in West Lothian. So if you live a half a mile away in Linlithgow, you can't go to Champney Restaurant because it's in the wrong tier. We've got so many stupid things like that going on. And what I don't understand also is why you can't have a drink with a meal. I just don't get that.
Yeah. You can eat a Scotch egg, can't you, though? You can have a Scotch egg.
A Scotch egg. I know. They're horrible things.
Yeah, I've never liked them.
No, Jesus. Not great.
What's all this about a Scotch egg? You know, I think, God almighty. Jeez, I don't know. Somebody said, oh, you can get Scotch eggs with black pudding in them. I mean, you
yeah,
know,
I was just going to say that. Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Do you? Well, yeah, you know, well I did a wee tweet one day. I said, black puddings matter, and I lost followers. I saw a tweet once I thought it was very funny. It said, black olives matter. Somebody had put an O in front of the L. But yeah, no, I actually think that what happened is they got it wrong in the beginning. Then the model was wrong. Then you've got so many people that have actually made so many decisions. They've spent so much money. They've blocked the economy off.
Yeah.
They've had to print money left, right, and centre to protect the economy, to protect jobs. And it's a disaster.
But what about that? I mean, what about the economic fallout? You know, all this debt we keep hearing about, and businesses struggling. You know, what's going to happen?
Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, but what I can tell you is that what they did was recommended for a long time by a guy called Richard Koo. Richard Koo, the macroeconomist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah,
he'd been saying for a long time that when you have a crisis of confidence or a crisis in the economy for whatever reason, then what you should do is print money and protect people from total loss. And what you should also do is spend money on infrastructure.
Mm.
And it is remarkable that if on the 23rd of March this year was the worst possible time for people to panic about lockdown. Lockdown, I think, started on the 23rd. The market started to plummet from about the 12th of March.
Mm.
And the Bank of America have what's called a fear and greed swingometer, which goes from green on the left-hand side to red. And on the right hand side, so zero or whatever the colours are, but it goes from 0 to 10, like in an arc. Zero, anything below 2 is extreme fear by investors, and anything above 8 or higher is extreme greed.
Mm.
So on the 23rd of March, that indicator for the first time ever hit zero. There was such extreme fear, it went to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And only by the middle of January, it's still been at 7.4. So it was close to extreme greed.
Mm.
It went to zero. And people panicked. And loads and loads of people basically cashed out at the bottom. But the interesting thing is, since then, 8 months later, the S&P 500 index is up 65%. The index, the UK index, is only up about 32, something like that.
Mm.
But a very substantial thing. And what we've always said to people at times like that is the best thing to do is don't do anything. Don't listen to the pain. Don't panic.
Mm.
Don't miss out, because what you're going to do is miss the bounce. Now, at the time, everybody said is, well, how many years is it going to take? Well, it's the fastest recovery ever. So something's going on out there. The cash, a lot of the cash that was created, or this theoretical money that's been printed, is basically sitting in deposit accounts. is sitting. It's not being spent because you can't spend it. So there's more liquidity at the moment than there's been for a very long time. And that liquidity is basically costing you, it's costing governments hardly anything because interest rates are almost at zero. And I would imagine central bankers are going to keep them like that for a long time. Mm. And inflation will be allowed to come into the system somehow. And presumably it will inflate away the debt, if you see what I mean, like it did in the 70s. I think that there are always winners and losers. And one of the best fund that I have in my pension fund is up 93% since the 23rd of March. Yeah. And unfortunately for Kenny, the gold is only up 7%. But the gold.
Well, I'm a silver man, Alan.
You're a what?
I'm a silver man.
Silver. Well, we could bounce on to that, actually. Yeah. This is something that might be. I don't know a lot about commodities, but it would appear to me that the demand that's going to come through, and it's already coming through in China very substantially in the Far East, that the demand is pushing up the prices. You might have noticed the price of oil has been rising quite a bit.
Copper's at
And the dollar's going down, which helps emerging markets in the Far East. So it would appear that there is a new cycle beginning and commodities are going to start increasing in price. Now, I don't know an awful lot about that, to be honest, because I just like companies. I understand that better than things like that. But I have a pal who does, and he's a billionaire, and he was on Master Investor, the virtual Master Investor show at the weekend. And he did his presentation. His name is Jim Mellon. You've probably heard of him. I've known Jim for 40 years. I was lucky to meet him when both of us had nothing. He's got a lot more than nothing, and I've got some more than nothing. But he's a very astute individual. He believes that he sees gold as being a decent hold. He thinks that it could go to 2,500 or more by the end of next year. That's what he thinks. That's what he said. Mm. But even better than that, he reckons that he said the silver price at the moment was about $40.
The moment it's $25 at the moment.
Right. All right. If it's that, then he sees the possibility of that going to 60.
That's why I've been, Mark's got some as well, but I've started buying physical silver. I'm trying to get to 1,000 ounces, so I'm sitting about 600 ounces at the moment. Try and get it to 1,000 just either before Christmas or after Christmas, because that's what I think as well. I think $100 silver's not out of the question, because there's so much silver used in industry as well now. And especially.
Solar, apparently. It's an interesting, it's something that's important to solar power. The only thing is that in the past, silver has tended to be very volatile. When it does hit a peak, it can fall back very heavily, very fast. So obviously the answer is to be diversified. And what I tend to do is that I would prefer a fund manager to make these decisions rather than me, because I wouldn't be very good at it.
I think
it's interesting.
I was just going to say, I think one of the mainstream banks has started hoarding it. I'm trying to remember. It may have been JP Morgan or something. They're starting to, as well as obviously buying gold, they're starting to hoard silver as well. Mm. Now, obviously, the silver to gold ratio is about 80-1 or something at the moment. So, to physically store silver is obviously a lot more difficult than storing gold. So, yeah, it's interesting that the banks are starting to buy up silver. And I'll try and find the article while we're talking. Just on you go, Alan, continue.
It's interesting because, I put that in because I know that you're really keen on silver and gold or whatever. And I was interested listening to what Jim was saying. I mean, he always also says that there are benefits elsewhere as well in terms of stocks, and he thinks the pound is undervalued. He thinks the UK market is undervalued significantly. And that's interesting too, because the consensus view of most people is that the UK stock market's not doing very well. And over a year, it hasn't done particularly well, I suppose. I think it's still down about, including reinvested dividends, if there's any, it's down about 5% or something like that. But interestingly enough, some sectors of underloved stocks within that index have got a fund that I really like the manager. I've known him a long time, and he's a good stock picker. And he's up over 70% since March. So there's value quite across the board, and I think diversity is really important.
Yeah.
But on that point about gold, I don't know about what the size of the silver market is, but I saw this article about gold because I was looking at debt at the time, because everybody seems to think we've got debt. And I got a wee greasy spoon in Bowness, and we have the Brains Trust, you know, Farmer, retired Giner, people are. And we were saying, oh, Alan, look at the debt. And I said, how do you work that out? And they went, well, because it's obvious, it's on the telly all the time. And it's the debt compared to GDP. You know? And I said, well, what's GDP? And the farmer thought it was something to do with produce. But they got gross domestic product. I said, well, I prefer guest domestic product, you know, as in I guess. Because how do they work it out? You know, because it's supposed to be the movement of goods and services on in an economy. It's an income, measure of income, allegedly, in the economy. But what are they measuring? And who's measuring it? Because there's billions of things happens in the economy. You can't imagine a couple of you wifeies sitting down sort of saying, right, how many tubes of toothpaste was that? Right, put that in. And so I just don't think that GDP probably measures very accurately what's going on. And it's got all sorts of things. I'll give you an example. I mean, like, do you use Wikipedia?
When I'm desperate, I'll look for information, but you can't rely on it.
But if you want to, all right, okay, it's maybe a bad example. But there's, if you want to know something out in the big world, there's all sorts of people have gathered that information. And there's some very good bloggers out there and some people who, some real great experts on different things. And you can access all that information for nothing. So when you're accessing information that might help you to add value to your business or to what you're going to do next, that's not adding anything to GDP. If I was your next door neighbour, and I cut my grass and you cut your own grass, nothing gets added to GDP. But if I pay you to do your grass and you pay me to do my grass, at say £20 each or something, that's £40 on GDP, allegedly. Although who's going to work it out? Because who's going to notice it? And if you think of all the developments that have gone on, all the inventions that have gone on that have pushed the prices of goods down the way over the last 30 years, the price of televisions and iPads, and if you think of all these things that are going on, that doesn't, not only does it not add to GDP, but it detracts from GDP. So to compare GDP today with the GDP of the 1950s, to me, is a farce. I just didn't get it. And then when you go in and sort of say, and anyways, what I saw a headline that said that world debt is 265% of world GDP, right? And I go, so what's GDP then? I think it must be pretty easy to calculate the debt, I would imagine. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I think that's a simple thing. I'm not so sure about how you work out what GDP is. But I think, why is it comparing it to an arbitrary annual income figure that's actually clearly very difficult to measure and is probably wrong? Why don't they compare it to world global assets? Well, there's a challenge for you. You go in and you try and find out what the world global assets are, because you can't find it. And if you're looking at a balance sheet, you look at assets and liabilities, don't you? You don't compare the liabilities to the income side of it. You compare it to the assets. So what's global assets? And I would suggest it's a hell of a sight more than the global debt. But then that doesn't make a headline, does it?
No, and
I mentioned to Mark yesterday when we were having a wee chat that a gram of gold According to the World Gold Council, who I didn't know existed, they say there's been 190,000 metric tons of gold that have been mined that actually exist at the moment, never mind what's in the still to be mined. And a gram of gold is $60, and there's 1 million grams in a ton. So that's $60 million a ton, and there's 190,000 tons of them. If you add up all that, I don't know what it comes to, because I can't be, I've only got a calculator that can calculate it, but it would strike me that's an awful lot of money just in gold alone.
Yeah, but actually, when you compare the size of the gold and silver market to Apple, it's still miles behind Apple. So they are. It's crazy when you think about it, how one company can actually be bigger than the precious metals market out there.
Well, it's, but the company itself, is just because it's allegedly, according to the people who buy the shares, it's allegedly worth over $2 trillion, right?
Yeah.
But is it really, really worth that? If you see what I mean, you know, there's been examples in the past, and I'm not necessarily saying it's the case with Apple, but there's been examples in the past that different bubbles, when you had a company with something like 37. It was something like 37 million pounds of sales, and it was valued at 36 billion pounds. And you know, you think, how can that be? But that's what happens. And of course, look at Tesla. I mean, Tesla is an unbelievable. It's got 14. It keeps attracting money despite the fact that it only made a profit last quarter for the first time.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's got 14 trillion. No, it can't be 14 trillion. It might be 14 billion sitting in a bank or something like that, of people who are actually desperate to give it money. And it's now worth, Tesla is now worth more than all the other major car manufacturers.
Yeah.
And you think, that's an oddity, you know. Having said that, I have funds with Bailey Gifford, who are big Tesla fans, and I have to say I've made a few bob on that one over the years. So it'd be worth keeping our eyes on what they do with their holding, because it must be pretty significant.
Yeah. Just moving back to the silver. So yeah, it was JP Morgan. So in 2011, they had 0 ounces of silver in their vaults. If you step forward, so this article's end of 2018, they had 120 million ounces. So they've pretty much, in the last 7 years, went from nothing to 120 million ounces.
So yeah.
Interesting. It'd be nice to see what their up-to-date figure is for 2020. I might have a good look for that later. But no, there's definitely a swing towards banks starting to store silver as well as gold. So that's another factor.
There's also a swing, one that you're not picking up, I don't see picking up very anywhere, is that there's been a huge swing in house construction in the US, you know, in the last year or so, huge number of houses. There's actually a shortage of new homes in the US. Now, that's fascinating, because that means that the demand is very high. Which, if you think about it, means that people are optimistic about the future, especially the younger people are optimistic about the future. So, you know, I think that there's a fair chance that we're in a new cycle, but it will not be all the way straight up. There will be bumps along the way, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was a bump early next year. I mean, down the way. Because if you remember, I mentioned this fear and greed indicator, which had gone from 7.4 on the greed side in January to zero on the 23rd of March. The last time I looked, which was a few days ago, it's 9.1. That lies seriously in the extreme greed period, and usually when it goes in there, a shock comes along to pull it back again. So it seems to me that maybe people are getting a bit too blasé. It may well be the fact that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that there's vaccines, that a lot of liquidity, interest rates haven't gone up at all. Inflation seems to be still benign. The young are buying hussies. China is booming again. So maybe we've got a point where the sentiment's too high, because I've followed that these sentiment indicators for, well, the best part of 20 years. And I tell you that what happens is that when investors get too when they get too optimistic, when they actually become blasé, they start to buy because the markets have gone up. And then when the indicators get too high, something comes along that actually deflates their enthusiasm. You know, if you're feeling really high and having blah, 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 the slightest wee bump along the way, it can actually affect you. So it wouldn't surprise me if stock markets took a wee bit of a dive in January. But if they do, if I was advising anybody and they had some funds available, whatever asset it is they fancy, if it goes down, they should buy more of it.
Yeah, exactly. Have you heard of Kondratiev waves, Alan?
Oh, yeah. That's the Russian.
What do you think of them? Anything behind it or not?
Well, it depends what the wave is measuring. Because if it's measuring an index, for example, an index is an arbitrary, it's an invented arbitrary thing. The FT index is capped. Well, most of the indices out there in the equity markets are capital weighted, which means that the bigger the company you're perceived to be, the more you take up of the index. So we get all this thing about the FANG stocks being 22% of the index because everybody wants to buy Apple and Amazon and Netflix and, you know what I mean, and Google and so on. So the index can get skewed because of that both ways. So you can get, if they're a really good company that nobody really likes for some reason or other, because it happens to be in the wrong sector, then people will be selling it to buy the stuff that's sexy and doing well. So the index, if you take the Kondratiev wave, if he's measuring something which is an arbitrary index, which doesn't actually make sense in the real world, then you just wonder, what's the point? That's what I'm trying to say, probably badly. But I've seen all these things before. I've seen so many of these indicators and graphs and things like that. And the one that I use all the time is the sentiment graph. If everybody's actually wanting to go that way, you're best to actually be a bit more cautious. If everybody's running for the hills, you're better to go in and buy. So that to me is an indicator that is in the real world, but as opposed to something that's actually a theoretical indicator that's actually linked to an arbitrary number that I don't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way I would tend to look at it. And the other thing really is, it's like what Warren Buffett's always said, you know, and this is away from the commodities like gold and silver, but if you're looking at businesses, buy great businesses, try and get them at a great price, that is cheap as much as you can because of a crisis, and then hold them. It's like somebody said, don't do something, just stand there. You know, you're turning it on its head. And the best ones that I've had for my clients and for my own wealth and my family's wealth over the last 30 years are funds where they buy great businesses at whatever size, either small caps or big cap, big funds. So they buy great businesses, they pay the right price for them, they keep their eyes on them, and through thick and thin, these businesses will make money. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I know it's boring, but hey, it works, you know? And that's what I think.
Okay. No, we speak to an economist, a Danish economist, and he's big into these Kondratiev cycles, and he sort of keeps saying that the gold's going to crash to 800, the US dollar's going to be strong, and we're going to hit the bottom of the Kondratiev winter. And that's what he's sort of waiting for, is he's convinced that within the next 6 months that's going to happen. There's going to be a rush to liquidity, US dollar's going to be strong, everything else is going to be down, then he's going to plough in. I don't know what your opinion on them was, that was all, because I know they take a very long a long view of everything. But I guess we'll...
As you probably know, I don't have a lot of time for economists. I can tell you that, let's take one of the most famous economists. I think you should do exactly the opposite of what he's suggesting. But if you take one of the most well-known, a legendary economist, is a guy called Paul Krugman.
Okay.
Nobel Prize winning, professor of this and professor of that. In November 1916, when Trump won the election, on the 8th of November, and it's still in Google, you can still Google it, he wrote in the New York Times when asked the question, asked the question, is when will the market recover? He said, our first pass answer is never. And he also then went on to predict a global recession without end. That was 4 years ago.
Okay.
And he was totally wrong. And he was also totally wrong back in 2009 when he predicted hyperinflation would come through, probably on some sort of basis like a Kondratiev wave or whatever. They were wrong. And economists by their nature appear to be pessimistic. You don't get many who are optimistic, do you?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I can't see any reason why the dollar will re-strengthen, because America wants the dollar. Basically, the American central bank and government want a weaker dollar because it helps global growth and emerging markets, and it helps their exports. Yeah. Everybody wants a strong currency until they get one.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, on that side, on the other side as well, with all that liquidity pumped into the system, and people, human beings on the planet, by and large, like being with other human beings, and they like spending money, and they've not had the opportunity for a lot of the world to spend money. They've been locked up, locked down, and they've been fed money to keep them going, and that money's just sitting around in bank accounts. And as soon as people can get out there, I can't guarantee it, but I will not be surprised if people start flying in planes again and start wanting to be in restaurants again and start wanting to be in offices with their friends again and so on. I think a lot of people are seriously pissed off by being on screens and sitting at home. And not human beings, by and large, they like company of other people, and they like enjoying themselves, and they like spending money and things like that. And to me, it's that the economists, I don't think economists understand that. Mm-hmm. They're a bit like actuaries, you know. They didn't live in the real world.
I bet
there's very few of them could tell you the price of a fish supper.
And they get paid. The actuaries get paid well, though, Alan. That's one of the best paid jobs out there, is it not?
Well, there's hardly any left.
Yeah, the risk management, isn't it, actually?
Well, if you actually look at it, I started off my life, post-university life in 1969, trying to be an actuary, because I'd heard that they made a lot of money. And I got a job at Scottish Widows, and I managed to persuade them that I was probably the missing link that they had been looking for. And within a very short period of time, I realised I'd made a big mistake, because these people can't communicate. And then you go forward all these years. When I started in the 60s, late 60s, in St Andrew's Square in Edinburgh, it was full of banks and insurance companies, particularly insurance companies, head offices. It was jam-packed room. Go along now and look and see how many are left. Because there's hardly any left. The actuaries obviously couldn't manage a piss up in a brewery, because they stood there and watched that industry basically decline and decline and decline and be taken apart by competitors like the unit trust industry and other savings industry and so on. And the ones that did survive had to be, with the exception of Standard Life, who went public, the rest of them basically had to be bailed out. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that there are many actuaries left, I would think. I wouldn't imagine so.
Yeah, certainly. I'm not. I've never met one, so can't.
But you're lucky. Yeah. You know what they used to say? Actually, you say, how do you tell the difference between an extrovert actually and an introvert actually? And the answer was that the extrovert actually looks at your shoes while he's speaking to you.
that's been over my head. Well, it has. Yeah, I sort of get it. Yeah, but so how's life been there, Alan Steele Asset Management? Then is the office running as normal? Business as usual?
Well, no, not at all. We on a typical day, we have, including me, there's 42 staff. On a typical day, there's six of us here in 7,500 square feet of office, and the rest of them are in the main working remotely. Within something like 3 days, my IT guy performed miracles by finding laptops and so on. We put in a new telephone system that basically linked everybody together as if they were in the office with external phones. Mm-hmm. It also links into their mobile phones, and it means that and we now have a receptionist that's here all day. We take incoming calls now through the receptionist, who then passes them. Just so you know, if somebody says, I want to speak to Graham, we'll just say, hang on a minute, I'll see if he's free. And as far as the client's concerned, he could be anywhere, but in fact actually he's sitting at home, or he might actually be, if he was on holiday somewhere, if he was lucky enough, he might be sitting somewhere on holiday and he can be contacted through his telephone. And I'd imagine you're saying, well, that's not exactly rocket science, but it is to a small business in Linlithgow. It was rocket science. And so what it's done is it's kept us kind of together. It's kept the clients in because we're able to communicate with the clients. And one of the, there's been a benefit actually, and the benefit is in the past, the only time we would be able to sit down face to face with a fund manager that we like or wanted to talk to would be if they were on a trip to Scotland. And they might do a Scottish trip every 6 months or maybe every year. Now we can do Zoom calls and Zoom meetings with fund managers at the drop of a hat. And every single week, in any week, there's probably three management meetings going on with the fund managers. So we've actually got a lot closer to the fund managers.
Yeah,
that's been a significant benefit, to be honest. And I think that will continue, guys. I think that people, the fund managers in London and Boston and so on that would normally be jumping on a plane to do their wee whistle stop tour of Scottish Central and talk to Azam and talk to other people, I don't think that's, I'd be surprised if that goes back to what it used to be. I think it's far easier for them to sit where they are and do a Zoom call. I think that is likely to be something that will continue. But I also, at the same time, think that it won't continue from the client's perspective, because clients are starting to tell us, we would rather come and sit down with you. You know, how do you evaluate with a new client? If you're a person out there and you're looking for an advisor to be a valued relationship investment advisor for a long time and to be sure that you, he or she will look after your partner after you're dead, because most men are still married to women, and in most relationships it's the man that dies first. And I can tell you over the years that one of the most important things they think is that I want somebody that I can rely on and trust for my wife, because of over the next few years. So how do you evaluate that level of trust when you're not sitting face to face, or you're not visiting the offices and feeling what it's like? Because we've got nice offices, and people say, you know, you get a really nice feeling when you come in, your receptionist is really nice, and I can see it's a serious business, and I can feel the relationship amongst the staff and things like that. All these things are really important.
Yeah.
You didn't get them on a screen.
No.
You actually have, you've got a better chance of picking that up actually on what we're doing just now, which is just like a telephone. You somehow or other more able to get a relationship on, say, like a telephone or audibly rather than visually, because once you're on a screen, the Zoom, there's no energy. There's, you know, maybe I'm wrong, maybe that's just me, but
yeah, I must admit, when I do Zoom calls, and Mark will back this up, I don't particularly like being on camera at all. And even when we are trying talking to guests, we tell them to turn their camera off because they relax more, so they do them, they're more at ease. And
aye.
You know, you can run your hands through your hair, you can look at your ceiling while you're talking. You know, you can do all your fidgeting or whatever you need to do to make yourself comfortable without the camera.
But yeah, you get what I'm saying then.
I think
there are people out there still, we're still getting quite a few inquiries. People, you get recommended by their friends or whatever, and they want to talk to us. And I always say to them, it's really important that you get the feel for who we are. So why don't you come to our offices, see what our offices look like, get the feel for what our staff appear to be look like, you know, get that impression, build these impressions, rightly or wrongly. You might not like us, that's fine, but you get that impression, you can feel the trust starts to, you know, you can tell within quite a short period of time whether you like somebody or no, but then it's more than that. But if they can't come to the office, you know, unlike the fund managers, we're not all that fussed. Once we've met a fund manager and we built a relationship, we're not that fussed if they're going to want to jump on a train and come up here or fly up here and come to Europe. We're not that fussed. But as long as we can talk to them and ask them the questions about their process and get a feel if they're changing their process and how they feel about value and where the unloved stocks and where's the future lying and things like that, that's what we want to know. We can do that on Zoom. So I think that will change. But I can imagine that people will be desperate to go on holiday and get into some sunshine. And like I went to October, I went to Ibiza for 3 weeks. It was fabulous. So civilized.
Yeah, I don't even know what the travel restrictions are in Scotland. I don't even bother my backside looking because it just, everything just changes daily. I mean, it's the same in most countries, but it's you probably need to spend your whole day watching all these Prime Minister's question times and then...
Nothing could give... No, oh, dear. You know, I haven't watched one news programme at all since the 8th of March.
Oh, yeah.
No, I haven't even bought a newspaper since the 8th of March.
Okay.
I just don't want to know. Because what you're getting is you're getting a one-sided view and it's usually bad news. And you can tell that when I'm speaking to a client, and I was speaking to my cousin who's a client, he used to be an airline pilot, but he kind of got a job. He said to me yesterday, he came down to see me as I was leaving the house, and he said to me, "Market's still up and down, is it?" I went, "Where do you get that impression?" He says, "Well, it's what you know. It sounds like so up and down. It's." Seems to be all over the place, according to the television. I said, how many times did I tell you not to listen to television? I said, the fact is, actually, that your stuff has been going up like a train since March. Oh, that's good, he said. You think, how does he not notice that, you know? So I say to people, I've said to my clients for a long time, look, the best thing to do is pit it off, open a bottle of wine, you've got a nice fire, get a fire going and put some music on and be oblivious to what's going on there, because it's just bad. All they do is feed you one bit of bad news after another, and they ignore all the good news. And there's a lot of good news out there. So I think, I hope I live for a long time to see it, but I actually think that we're in for 2 or 3 good years, actually. And if you've got the right diversification of asset, and you're aligned to a growth trend on the global economy, I think you'll do all right. I think you'll do very well. Mm-hmm. If on the other hand you go around believing the world's going to come an end and you put your money into treasury bonds or gilts or things like that, there's more chance of interest rates peaking up, you know, turning up at some point, and there's a fair chance that you make no money for 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I think it was you that said one of your previous podcasts, Alan, that tallest buildings in the world weren't built by pessimists.
No, that's right. No, it's true. It's true. And I'm talking about the tallest buildings in the world. It's interesting the way that the second biggest fund we've got is our striker, if you want to call it that. It's our Lewandowski or whatever his name is, or Messi or whatever, or Ronaldo. And he actually made the point, when he looks at the way he looks at holding stocks, he looks at big companies, but he also looks at themes. And he said, he believes, and this was the first time we ever met him was 9 years ago, and it's still the same. He still believes the same thing. He believes that one of the biggest areas of growth in the world is high-rise buildings in places like China and the Far East and the Middle East and so on, and even in the States, high-rise buildings. He says, what do you need in a high-rise building that you have to pay for that's very, very important, and it's so important that it has a service contract. And the service contract is regular and it goes up all the time. So you're making money as you're putting it in, and then you're making even more money over the years servicing it. And you go, I give in. And he goes, I lift. And you go, oh, right, enough. All right. So he then says, right, how many lift manufacturers are there in the world that I can actually own shares in? Because one of them, I think, is a private company. He says they don't need our money. But all this shit, I think there's three, what he's saying is that they have significant old family money still in the companies. So he says, that'll do me. I'll buy a couple of these lift companies and I'll just put them in the portfolio if I can get them at a decent price. I like thinking like that.
Yeah, simple, isn't it?
I like thinking like that. And one of the other ones, he said that drugs will be required increasingly. He says, now I don't know which pharmaceutical companies are going to win through on the drugs. He says, but I can tell you that they all require something that actually takes a needle and sticks it in your arm and then throws it away. So who makes these, whatever you call them, what do you call that? You inject the drug into your body. So
a syringe,
a wee plastic syringe. He said, who makes the plastic syringes? Right, I'll find which companies make them, which are the best companies in the world. Because he said this is just going to be increasingly being used because they throw them away. And the more and more, and the older people are, the more they're going to get help and drugs and healthcare and so on. That'll do me. So he goes, right, I'll have that. There's a company I like. Again, I like that. I like that thinking. That's like, that guy's pretty clever. So he doesn't say, I'll buy the pharmaceutical company because, as he says, he doesn't know which one's going to win or what drug's going to be required. But he does know that they're going to have a syringe to put them into your body.
Yeah.
Etc.
And then once the syringe is done, you've got to have one of these needle safe disposal bins as well. So there's always the need for them, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and if you look at, you know, there's one of the, a very, very bright guy in America that I got to know when he was at Ned Davis Research, and he's now another company in America, and he's called Vincent Dollard. He's French, but he's got a remarkable brain in him, and he was doing some work. He's done work on what were the great themes of each decade, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you know, which theme, looking back, was the major theme, and what theme should there be going forward, the next decade, the decade from now on, the next 10 years, what theme do I think will win through? And he comes to a pretty obvious conclusion, is healthcare, especially kicked by the pandemic. He thinks, look at the money that will be spent on healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at that and you think, that actually makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Healthcare.
Yeah, well, everybody's living longer, aren't they? Or wanting to live longer. They'll try anything, won't they?
Well, it's there's so much work being done just now on solving things like dementia. There's a lot of work being done on solving dementia. There's a lot of work being repairing, heart valves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. a lot of work being done on kidney redevelopment and all that. So there's a fair, and then you've got the terrible thing that have happened in the last 8 months or so with COVID and the amount of deaths there's been in the older age groups and so on, and the panic. You would think that they would have learned. And I remember, I said there was a quote at the beginning, wasn't it, about decades, sometimes nothing happens for decades, and then the next thing is decades happen in weeks. And I think that's fairly true about the healthcare industry. I think that the amount of money that's now going to be spent looking at healthcare will be considerable, and there will be winners there and losers. And I think it makes sense to find, I think it makes sense to find a fund manager who is analysing all that rather than just buying one or two stocks. But then that's the way I am, I guess. Everybody's different. It's more tax efficient as well if you've got a fund that's buying and selling inside the fund, rather than you buying and selling individual stocks, because you're going to pay capital gains. And there's a fair chance that the capital gains tax is going to rise in the UK.
Don't mention that.
I know. Sorry about that. But I think it's pretty plain that the government have made such an arse of things, and they've created all this debt. And despite inflation repaying it, et cetera, they're going to want some more taxation to pay for it. And guess what they're going to do? They're going to pick on the investors.
That's why you should buy the Royal, because they're CGT free.
At the moment, they will listen. If they want to raise money, they'll decide. They'll change their mind. And they're also now talking about a one-off wealth tax. That would be payable over 5 years for anybody, including all assets, by the way, including your pension fund and your domestic home, as well as everything else. So it's not good news. And there you go. You just have to make more money to pay for it.
Well, yeah. Well. Yeah. That's great. It's been good talking to you again, Alan. It's been a little while, hasn't it, since we spoke?
Well, it's been so long. I couldn't remember my password.
Your password for the Skype, yeah.
I have no idea. And when you go in to make another password, I mean, it's really complicated. It's like it's like trying to select the best airfare model or something like that. I mean, it's like go like, well, why can't I just put another password in? You go, oh no, you need a code. Well, where's the code? Oh, you have to send us one. Right, so I'm starting to do that, and then the message comes in saying, "Hey, what we'll do it in Zoom." And I went, "Perfect."
Yeah, well, it's been good, and I guess we can catch up again. Well, sometime in the new year after Brexit, see what the fallout is from that.
It's entirely up to you guys. If you think I had any sort of value or anything like that, then that's wonderful. And if you think I'm just talking a load of crap, then that's fine as well. I just believe the things I believe, and I like digging into things. If everybody thinks something's an idea, you go, well, let's just check that. And that's when you come up with things like how daft GDP is. Because you actually, you know, it's the same. I remember something a long time ago. It was a good few years ago. I think it was JP Morgan. It was either JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley, who sat down and calculated all the exports of countries in the world, and they counted all the imports of the countries in the world, and they added them together. And as everybody knows, that should come to zero, because if you're exporting and somebody's importing, and you do it for all the countries in the world, if you add them up, then it should come to zero, shouldn't it? Because 100% exports going out the way, 100% imports coming in the way, different places right enough, it should add to zero. And they discovered that the world was trading in deficit with itself to the tune of trillions of dollars. And they go, well, how can that be? And the reason is because the numbers are rubbish.
Yeah.
Because some people will just go like, what did we put? We're like, you know, Tam, what was it we, what did we put down last year, Tam? You know, well, I think we put down 2.3 trillion. Oh, we'll make it 2.4 this time. You know, and what about imports? Oh, I don't know. You know, we didn't like getting imports, so we'll put that. So you can, yeah, I'm being silly about it, but the numbers didn't add up. And it was when I learned that, then I thought, I wonder what other numbers didn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just accepting, you know, the headline in the paper, you know. Was the worst. It was a record level of hurricanes in 2020. And you go, I wonder if that's true. And of course, it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, why did they get away with that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, nice talking to you.
Well, thanks a lot, Alan. That's fantastic. It's been great having a catch up with you. And we'll hopefully catch up early 2021.
Anytime, Mark. Mark, you know, if people like listening to a bit of nonsense as well, then I'm your man. I'm quite happy. I'm keeping reading as well. I will not stop reading.
Good. Reading is good. Reading is very good. Excellent. Very good. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Alan.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.